Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the show that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whoever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. We've got a really great show coming up for you. I've asked Bruce King to join us and talk about natural building and making change. If you know anything about natural building in the United States, then you'll have heard of Bruce. He's been a steady advocate for new and better ways of building for decades. I've personally known and admired Bruce's work for many years, and I read last year his new book, The New Carbon Architecture, Building to Cool the Climate, and thought, we got to get Bruce on the show. So Bruce is a registered structural engineer and a longtime leader within the green building movement. He is the co-founder and director of the Ecological Building Network, a nonprofit coalition of engineers, builders, and architects developing and disseminating best technologies for the built environment. He's also the co-founder of the Green Building Press and the author of three books, Buildings of Earth and Straw from 1996, Making Better Concrete from 2005, and Design of Straw Belt Buildings in 2006. As you'll hear in the interview, Bruce is visionary in how he believes our means of building could change. And yet at the same time, he's grounded and practical in the lessons that he offers about how to be a designer and a leader, now more than ever. So without further ado, let's hear from Bruce about how to change the world. Bruce, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Bruce, we're tackling this climate crisis and this climate emergency, and you know, we're approaching it from a couple of different angles. And you know, you and I met a long time ago, and I specifically wanted to speak and get your insights across the whole arc of this movement. I mean, you've been doing what you do for decades, and I think that natural building, natural materials, these sorts of things, they've come in and out of vogue, and you know, we've made some advancements in terms of the codes and that sort of thing. And I think with the new recognition that this is a crisis, we're getting to a point where, you know, it's absurd to keep building the way that we've been building. And you know, a lot of the things that we looked at as quote unquote natural building in the past are just the ways that we have to do things now. Am I overstating that? Is that being dramatic?
No, not at all. Of course, Eric, you and I met in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, while we were both seeing if we could make ourselves useful there, which was not as easy to do as we both had hoped, I suppose, it being such a difficult situation. But I came to Haiti, as you say, I have this background in so-called natural buildings, straw bale buildings, earthen building, bamboo, shipping containers, all sorts of things. And I was attracted to it, partly because it's a bunch of really fun, creative, smart people inhabiting that world. And so it was a great crowd to hang out with. But because I sensed that it had something good to offer to the world as a whole, that there was something valuable there that wasn't quite so obvious besides just the fun of putting up a straw bale house. So I thought a lot about it and wrestled around it and started to sort of tease out the underlying principles that make what you just said true. In other words, what makes so-called natural building is that you're using things as you find them in the landscape with minimal alteration and minimal transportation, i.e. minimal changing in chemical molecules and minimal expenditure of fuel, especially fossil fuel. And that turned out to apply a bit in Haiti, looking around at how we could help Haiti rebuild with what they already had there, which in that case was a lot of concrete rubble and a lot of unemployed young people who would love to do anything to earn a buck. That's a whole story in itself. But fast forward a few years, and here we are now. And I think, notwithstanding the naysayers or the deniers in our and other countries, there's a lot more awareness around the climate emergency now. And again, I'm wondering, what is natural building bringing to that? And again, it's the same thing, is that it's a very short supply chain. You're using what's already there. You're making use of stuff as it is, as our ancestors all did in building shelter. But nowadays, you can do that and still get elegant, modern, sophisticated buildings with a lot less burning of fossil fuels and a lot less weird chemicals. That's the exciting part of it.
Well, let's talk about that exciting part. You know, what's changed? How has the landscape evolved? I guess I'm thinking specifically, have you noticed a wider acceptance of natural building, let's say, over the last 10 years?
It's hard to say. It's sort of leveled off here in California. Like, doing a straw bale house is no big deal. It's kind of a, oh yeah, fine, in most building departments I'm aware of. But it's taking off like gangbusters in other parts of the world, like Australia and France I'm aware of. and it has spread all over the world. And natural building in general has grown, and I would say there's on the order of something like 10,000 people who in one fashion or another would call themselves natural builders or interested in it, which isn't very much. Catching my attention is sort of a next generation of natural building, such as prefabricated straw bale buildings. They're doing great stuff in Europe and Australia. In particular, this company EcoCocon, E-C-O-C-O-C-O-N. I think I got an extra CO in there, EcoCocon.
This guy, we'll link to it on the website.
Norwegian guy working out of Latvia is making prefab mass timber and straw buildings, and his goal is to achieve passive house level of airtightness and efficiency with minimal use of fossil fuel-based materials, minimal use of plastics. And he's got hundreds of buildings completed now. He's doing really great work. And they're not just little houses either. They're big commercial buildings. To which I answer your question. That's where natural building is going. There are still, and there probably always will be, a sort of a fun, cultish sort of subset of people who want to build their own house in the woods kind of thing. It's a stereotype, but very much alive. And that's, you know, a fun bunch of people. And it's all great. I just take issue with them when they start thinking this is what's going to save the world, is everybody gets their quarter acre in the woods and builds a cob cabin and everything's going to be great. These are people who just haven't traveled to China lately or India or Egypt, like where I just was, and seen quite a different reality than what they see in Western North America or Vermont or wherever they happen to be.
So let's talk about the new reality. You know, one of the things that's always impressed me about your work is kind of, you know, taking things away from that stereotype of, you know, living in a cob house in the woods and, you know, looking at mid-rise buildings, looking at tall timber structures and these sorts of things. How has the landscape changed over the last couple of decades in terms of, from an engineering standpoint, you know, what we're able to do with wood and straw?
Well, wood is something in itself. Mass timber construction is kind of all the rage in architecture right now. It's the hip thing to do. People are competing to do taller and taller timber structures here and there. I don't even know what the current tallest is, 15 stories in Vancouver, I think. British are doing a lot, and the Australians are doing a lot. And it's kind of exciting because engineering-wise, we couldn't even do this up until about 10 years ago. That is, we couldn't build taller than 8 or 10 stories with anything other than steel and concrete. Now, in a sense, that's not true because the historical evidence shows otherwise. But generally, to engineer a building to really last very long, you had to use steel or concrete, very high-strength materials and also high-carbon materials. But that's not true now. We can basically take wood, small pieces of wood, and mill them and glue them together into columns and beams and slabs and have an all-wood structure now. And they can be really beautiful, and they can also be really inexpensive. The U.S. Army built a huge mass timber hotel building down in Alabama years ago, simply on the basis of cost. It went up cheaper and faster. The caveat, the large caveat there from the global perspective, is that if we suddenly start using a lot more wood, well, what happens to the forest? Is that really
I was going to ask about that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I wrote this book, The New Carbon Architecture, and has a whole chapter on mass timber, extolling the beauty of mass timber buildings and how exciting all that is. But it also has a companion piece on the sustainable forestry side. The short answer to that is we could conceivably ramp up our use of timber in construction so as to build carbon buildings. But we're not on a trajectory to do that right now. We do not practice sustainable forestry. In North America, I think the sort of very mild certification, SFI, Fox Guarding the Henhouse kind of sustainability, has a large, pretty good share of the market, and most of the big industry players are signing on with it and doing it. And it's better than nothing, but it's not that good. Whereas the Forest Stewardship Council, the sort of gold standard, lumpy and imperfect as it is, I don't know if it even has a percent of the market yet. They just haven't penetrated much. And so we're not on a path to really take proper care of our forests and use more wood in construction. That's the sidebar on wood. The broader thing, though, is my personal hope and prediction is that as we start to put a price on carbon such that people are motivated to go in that direction, we won't even use wood anymore. We'll take the enormous volume of agricultural byproducts we've got, straw being just one, and learn to glue them together and make straw lumber and straw slabs and straw insulation and all sorts of things with our agricultural byproducts and have truly carbon architecture that sequesters carbon, pulls it out of the sky and absorbs it.
You know, that reminds me of a phrase that comes up often in your book, buildings made of sky. Can you share with the audience what that means?
I guess I just did, but I'll say it again. It it just hit me when I was writing this book. I started out on the project a few years ago because I've been working with a lot of exciting people here and there working on the notion of embodied carbon, which till recently has been pretty much ignored in the not just the architectural community, but even the green building community. And now we're suddenly realizing it's a really big deal. So I wanted to write something for a general audience about how you got to pay attention to the embodied carbon of buildings just as much as the operational carbon. A big takeaway, if you, a listener right now could take anything out of this conversation, it'd be that a project you build this year will have impact on the climate. And over the next 20 years, 3/4 of that impact is from the embodied emissions, not from the operating emissions. It matters a lot what materials you choose to build with and how careful you are with that. And the good news is you can have low embodied emissions and low operating emissions, and people are starting to do that. People are even doing net positive buildings that sequester more carbon than they ever emitted. The notion of buildings made of sky was simply because, as I wrote about embodied carbon and looking at mass timber and evolution of straw construction and so on, it suddenly hit me that there was this huge positive bit of news there looming, which is that we can build with carbon. In fact, we need to. It's an imperative to the architectural and construction community that we should build with carbon. That is, pull the carbon back out of the air and sequester it durably and permanently on the ground, a building made of sky.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Bruce King on buildings made of sky. But we're going to take a quick break. While we're breaking, check us out on social media, where you can find out more about Bruce, his work, and find links to his books. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IM. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about all things carbon and why you should or should not contemplate giving up whatever you're doing to work on some building codes. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We've been speaking with Bruce King, natural builder and structural engineer, and coming up, we're going to be talking in a lot more detail about embedded carbon and how we make that a deeper part of the conversation. Let's rejoin the show. Bruce, before the break, we were talking about embodied carbon, and that recently came up in another interview. At a popular level, generically, I think people really throw that term around. Can you set the record straight? What's embodied carbon?
The embodied carbon of a building project is the emissions associated with making or processing all the various materials, as well as all the people driving around to the job site. Everything it took to the point where somebody's handing the new owner of the building a key and say, here's your building. All the emissions that have happened up until that point are the embodied emissions. After that, you turn on the lights, you turn on the air conditioning, you turn on the Wi-Fi. You turn on the heater in the winter and so on. Those are the operating emissions. And those, over a 60 to 100-year lifetime of a building, those operating emissions have typically dwarfed the embodied emissions, far, far bigger. And that's why for the past quarter of a century, since green building was even a thing, everybody's been focused on operating emissions, better insulation, better windows, better air conditioning systems, better lights, and so on, which is fine. And we'll continue to do so, and that's all good. We know how to do net zero buildings. We don't, but we know how to anyway. What we haven't worked is how to get all the embodied emissions out, that big hit of carbon at the front end, which is extra important because it is at the front end. You build something this year. Maybe you build a passive house. It's a really cool building. It's going to have net zero emissions, and everybody's really happy about it. But you put a big wad of carbon in the air just in the course of meeting it, and that carbon is in the air now and working forever after, a so-called time value of carbon, because it's acting on the climate longer, as opposed to all those emissions that you saved by building a highly insulated building. I don't mean to poo-poo that. I just mean that if you really want to do the climate effect, you actually get situations where you think, I'll add that extra inch of rigid insulation all the way around my house or my office building or my school to get from super efficient all the way to passive house standard, something like that kind of thinking. And that might be great for your energy bill and your feel good for everybody, but it actually wasn't a good thing for the climate. You ended up putting more emissions in the air right when we don't need them because of all the emissions associated with most rigid insulations. Once again, I hate to be frustrating, but once again, it's not always such a simple situation. What we thought was just adding more insulation can never hurt you. No, that's not true.
So why is that, Bruce? I mean, why is the conversation so omitted, this discussion of embodied carbon, and what do we do about it? I mean, read the book, obviously, but like, how do we change that conversation?
Well, it's mostly because people just aren't aware. You know, I run around, as do a number of my colleagues, talking at every chance I get. People just don't know about it. They just haven't heard about it. And I have to deliver the message carefully. I was in Las Vegas for the AIA convention 2 weeks ago, talking with a couple of other people on this subject. And I was happy to see that the room was full. We had a couple hundred people showed up for our presentation. But on the other hand, the general, as I looked at the agenda for the whole conference, I didn't see much that really got me excited. And as I walked through the bookstore, the conference bookstore, there was hardly anything about green or energy efficiency. It was still kind of all about glam and, well, other things. So partly people just don't know, and partly everybody's overwhelmed and they don't want to learn anything more. They don't want to learn about another problem they have to pay attention to. So you try to couch it as like, this is an opportunity we have and an imperative we have to rethink the way we build buildings. And it really is very exciting once you start to unpack it and look at it. Because as you started with here, we can't continue building the way we have been during the Industrial Revolution, which is based on a whole lot of cheap fossil fuel and a way, quote unquote, where we can throw things, be they gaseous emissions or solid emissions or chemical emissions. There is no way. It's all right here, and we can't operate that way anymore.
Well, let's springboard off that, because again, you know, another thing that I've always admired about your work and your career is your work in codes. And, you know, I frequently cite you to my students when, you know, they kind of complain about, well, you know, this doesn't change and that doesn't change. And, you know, I try and talk to them about being a designer, an architect or engineer, as also advocate, right? I mean, you don't have to be a captive of, you know, some code that was written 20 years ago. If you know what the right thing is to do, go out and advocate for it. Now, you have helped write or have written building codes all over the world. Can you share with the audience a little bit about that experience and, you know, how you got started doing that and what lessons we might draw out of that?
I don't think anybody, you know, grows up dreaming of working in building codes. I didn't hang out on the playground staring dreamily into the sky, thinking one day I'm going to grow up and work on building codes.
But you did it.
It's just a truly awful way to spend your time. It really is. But that's because it's a high leverage thing. And that means there's a lot of people who care about it. And that means there's a lot of money floating around. And that means it can be a bit of a rough and tumble world, not in the sense of actual daggers and bullets, but metaphorical equivalents of them. So I worked on early straw bale building codes, and then I got interested in earthen building. And I was hanging out with this small handful of engineers who had been doing a lot of seismic research on earthen buildings and generating all sorts of really great stuff. All of them with the in the spirit of service, of trying to help the billion or so poorest people in the world who build with earth, because that's all they can afford. That's all they have available to them. And they die terribly in earthquakes, because earth is basically a pretty bad material for earthquakes. It's brittle and heavy, and it can come apart and crush you. But at the same time, it's not that hard to hold it together in a way that gives people a chance to get out alive. And these guys did some really high quality engineering in various places around the world, published a lot of great papers. And I kept badgering him, well, why don't we, you know, when are we going to get this out to the world? There's only like a couple hundred at the most who even know that this body of knowledge exists. And yet all these people are, billion people are at risk. So it was one of those things where I looked around and something needed to be done and nobody else was doing it. So I said, okay, I'll do it, which means I went and developed this standard with ASTM International, one of the big standards organizations in the world. What I thought would be a fairly straightforward process turned out to be 5 grueling years. And very shortly after I had finished it, and we'd published this building standard for earthen buildings that offered some guidance to people with no money to have some seismic safety, almost within weeks, the big earthquake happened in Haiti that brought you and me both down there, Eric. And I was immediately working with my colleagues and thinking about how could we apply this here? How could we apply the earthen building standard to country with a whole lot of concrete rubble? And it turned out it was kind of useful, and the same sort of engineering thinking applied. So it was very useful in that regard. But writing a standard at that level, there's big industry players there who've got a lot more money than you and a lot more time on their hands. It's not easy to do. I'm currently now working on an amendment to the building code that will mandate low carbon concrete, which is, well, I'm quite confident it's the first time anybody's tried to do it in the world, because I keep looking around and I've been to international gatherings and asking everybody, and nobody's tried to address carbon emissions through the building code. It seemed like a great place to start addressing embodied carbon, because concrete is like the big target in the sense that it's the most common building material in the world, and it's also responsible for 8% of global emissions, almost all of that 8% being from the production of Portland cement, the glue that holds sand and gravel together and gives you concrete.
Wow.
And by the way, earthen construction is also concrete construction. It's just clay concrete, which has different properties that isn't quite as strong, and it can erode and so on. But historically, it's done great things, and there's great buildings that have endured for centuries that are made of clay concrete, i.e. earthen construction. But modern times, we think of concrete as cement concrete, and cement is made by burning limestone at very high temperature, and so there's a lot of emissions. I know in my career of 40 years as a structural engineer that every project I've been on, every concrete mix I was involved with had a lot more cement in it than it really needed. And that was just for good reasons. People, you throw the extra cement in there because it was relatively cheap and it was insurance against any kind of callback. You never worried about the concrete being under strength. You know, you don't want to build a building and get up to the fifth floor and find out your foundation isn't strong enough. You just don't want that to happen.
Yeah, put some more cement in it.
And so that's the mentality of the industry, very much entrenched. Just keep throwing more cement in there and don't think about it, which here in the affluent industrialized world was almost a no-cost thing. In a place like Haiti, it's a high-cost thing, but that's kind of a different conversation. But we set out here to write a building code that would take the most egregious forms of that and say, don't put that extra bag of cement in there. Don't put that extra topping on there. Let's just use what we can, what we have to get the strength or the durability or whatever it is we need. And it's just not very hard to do. There's various ways to do it, to reduce the cement content in concrete and still get the stuff you want. So that's what we're working on now. And in fact, we're having a big meeting in a couple of weeks, stakeholder meeting, probably be 30 people there from concrete industry and all sorts of people to finalize the language on the code, which will be adopted in Marin, Alameda, Contra Costa County, San Francisco. And then we will be exporting it as best we can all over North America. Actually, all over the world, getting inquiries from all sorts of places.
Bruce, that's amazing.
Especially China, yeah.
It's exactly the sort of activism that we love on this show. And, you know, a lot of our guests have that moment where they look around and they kind of feel like somebody should have been doing a thing and they realize nobody is. So they just kind of sit down and do it. And my students are always shocked to find out that concrete is 8% of the world's emissions. And, you know, a lot of the ways that we build it because mentally we're still in a space where, you know, we have free, unlimited petroleum and no consequences. And, you know, the earth will recover from everything. And that there's so many alternatives out there that we can be looking at. And, you know, it seems like a consciousness shift as much as anything. Or am I boiling that down too far?
It is. A cultural thing as much as a technological thing. There are technical issues to be dealt with, but they're not that hard to deal with. It's mostly, again, it's a very conservative industry. Unsurprisingly, I mean, you know, you're building the shelter that people are going to live in, and if you get it wrong, people die. You know, you tend to get kind of conservative. But yes, it's a matter of changing attitudes. And if you don't accept that humans are causing the changes in the climate, then you don't see the logic of changing the way we make concrete. And I've already encountered that. But around the Bay Area, that hasn't been too much of an issue. So it's a great place to start. And that's what we're doing. It's all about the carbon. If you're going into the building industry and you want to make a difference, you certainly can. But sometimes you have to be the one who just steps up and does it because nobody else is doing it. Don't be shy. Step on up.
Amen. Bruce, thank you so much. This has been amazing to catch up like this. And for our audience, we're going to link to all of Bruce's books on our website. You should definitely check them out. Bruce has been an inspiration for a long time in terms of how he is engaged, designed for, and advocated for natural building. And he's definitely someone you want to know.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's been great.
You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank my guest of the week, Bruce King, for his thoughts on evolving practice. To dig a little bit deeper into the technical, which you absolutely should, I recommend picking up Bruce's recent book, and all of his books actually, which cover different dimensions of green and natural building. We'll link to them on the site, and you can find them easy. Check it out at currystonefoundation.org. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can always write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. That's E-R-I-C at socialdesigninsights.com. Join us next week. We're headed all the way to Malaysia to catch up with Dr. Ken Yang. Ken and I had the fortune to spend some time together in Dhaka a couple of years ago, and I'm as inspired now as I was then. Can't wait to catch up and tell all of you more about his remarkable practice. Social Design Insights is produced by Baruch Zeichner, and at the break, we are listening to Green is Mean by Art Blakely and the Jazz Messengers, off of their album, One for All. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. And check us out on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IN for all the latest news on social impact design.